You're listening to Second Stories, created and produced by Second Story with me, Abigail Brocker, as your host. Second Story is a nonprofit based in Northern Virginia, working to provide safe havens and opportunities to grow and thrive to youth in crisis and their families. We help homeless youth and youth in crisis step away from their first story, one often marked by abuse, hardship, and crisis, and write their own second story, full of hope and promise.
Yeah, because there I was, 20 years old, a single welfare mother with no job, no money, no education, nothing. I started with absolutely nothing except a month-old child to take care of.
Renee has a law degree, a master's degree, and a PhD. Her dissertation contributed new research to an important academic field that may, quite literally, change our world. She had a high-powered career for more than two decades and has pursued not only her own dreams, but her vision for a better world full steam ahead. She has quite the resume. Renee was also born into poverty. She was a single parent. She was abused. She was a college dropout. Her beginnings were challenging for sure. And her upbringing and heartache are as much a part of her as are her degrees and her successes. Her life is a true testament to the fact that with the right support, our first stories do not have to dictate our future. We see in her a world changer as much as we see her early disadvantages. And in that, we are hopeful. We are even more resolved that regardless of a young person's challenges, with the right kind of intervention, they truly can do anything. Renee, thank you so much for being here. I'm really excited to talk to you. I think our conversation of all the interviews I've done has been one of the more interesting conversations I've had just because you have done so many interesting things. And we're going to get to that at the end. I'm really looking forward to that. I also love that if people have listened to season one, you know Tina, who we talked to earlier. And that's, I think, going to come kind of beautifully full circle at the end, too, as we talk about how people in our communities lead us into our second story. One of the things that stood out to me when we talked was you saying that you grew up kind of oblivious to the fact that you were poor, kind of oblivious to the uniqueness of your situation. Can you start off by talking about just how you grew up, how you ended up where you ended up as a child?
Sure. Let's see. I was born in Baltimore and along with my two siblings. And when I was six, my parents decided that they would move back to the small town in Pennsylvania where my father had been born and raised. It's called Ebensburg. Ebensburg is in the Laurel Highlands range of the Appalachian Mountains, so in the northern stretch of the Appalachians. And it's at the top of the watershed. But after a year, my father was having trouble finding steady work as a bricklayer because he had been trained also as a brick and stone mason. And so they first rented and then bought a small sort of rundown house out on 20 acres, about 10 miles outside of Ebensburg. And that's where I grew up. We didn't know that we were poor. My mother says that that first Christmas when we were in Ebensburg, we three children said that we didn't like the Santa Claus in Pennsylvania because he wasn't as generous as the Santa Claus in Baltimore. My mother was a nurse, but it took a while for her to get licensed in Pennsylvania, so she wasn't working and adding to the income. And while we were growing up on 20 acres, I mean, we had free range of, you know, the fields, the streams, the woods. We went to a local parochial grade school in a town that was 2 miles away called Nicktown. And the town surrounded the church called St. Nicholas. But everyone was in the same condition that we were. So, you know, no one had much money. It was mostly, you know, farmers, coal miners, steel workers. And towards the end of our time at St. Nicholas, they had uniforms, which was a great equalizer because you didn't know if anyone had better clothes than you.
Right.
So, you know, we had enough food. We had a car to drive. We had one of the first television sets around. And so, you know, we really had no idea that we were growing up in a poverty-stricken area. Didn't affect my sense of myself. Mm-hmm. But what it did affect was access to information, to cultural activities, right. You know, to things like that. Trips, you know, our vacations were always, you know, going to New Jersey to visit my father's mother, who was living with her son there. But we didn't realize that life could be any different.
Yeah. So how do you think that affected you, that lack of access to opportunities?
The best story I can tell about that is that I graduated second in my class in grade school and I think fifth in my class in high school. I went to a parochial high school here in Evansburg. And so I wanted to be a doctor. Actually, I wanted to be a psychiatrist. And first you had to be a doctor. Mm-hmm. And so I looked for the best college in the country, and I got a scholarship to Johns Hopkins, and I went down there majoring in chemistry. I went in, and I'd been getting straight A's in chemistry like everything else. I went into my first class in chemistry at Johns Hopkins, and we were handed a powder and told to find the molecular weight, and I had no clue how to do that. I had gotten straight A's in chemistry, but we weren't taught that, you know? So that showed me, and the other students knew exactly what to do. So that showed me that although I had gotten the best education possible in this area, it did not compare with what other kids were getting elsewhere in the country, and I couldn't compete with them.
Was that like something washed over you in that moment and realizing how different your life was than some of your peers? Or how did you feel in that moment when you couldn't do what you were asked to do and you thought you were going to be capable?
I asked a couple of the other students if they could help me, and they looked at me like I was crazy because they were used to competition and I wasn't, you know, because I come from a very collegial environment. So I was scared. I felt scared and alone, and I realized I was completely out of my depth and that I was probably going to fail.
I mean, it sounds devastating, but it sounds like it's more just a surprise.
Yes. First surprise and then fear.
Yeah.
And then horror.
Yeah. A really bad surprise. Yeah. So what did you do?
I dropped out and went hitchhiking around the country with my then boyfriend.
When I hear that, I'm like, oh, that is the opposite of what I'd expect out of a student who got a scholarship to Johns Hopkins.
Yeah. It kind of surprised everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. And disappointed everybody too, you know, because it's not every student from this area who gets a scholarship at Johns Hopkins. You know, my scholarship was in the local paper. And then to find out that I dropped out after half a semester, I disappointed the community quite a bit. And of course, my family too.
Yeah. So you take off hitchhiking. How long does this go on?
Off and on for about a year. And, you know, we would occasionally come back to this area and then take off. So I'd say, and I got married in the middle of all that, 5 days past my 19th birthday.
Wow. It's young.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really young. And your parents didn't like this guy, I presume.
No, they tried to separate me from him. And that draw was just too strong.
Was it more to do with what they felt like he was taking you away from?
There was that. He was 8 years older. We met when I was only 17, so, you know, I'm sure they had questions about pedophilia. Mm. And, you know, they felt that he was ruining my future. There were only two places in the country at that time where you could get married in only one day. His parents very much wanted me to marry him. My parents didn't want it, but his parents did. And so they took us to Winchester, Virginia, which was one of those two places, the other one being Las Vegas, Nevada.
Wow.
And they were our witnesses. And so I was married in Virginia.
Wow. Were you in Virginia then for a while?
No, we came right back to Pennsylvania. Okay. No, it was a day trip.
Wow.
And I had nothing. You know, I had no clothing that was decent. I borrowed a dress from his mother to wear. And I remember thinking throughout the quick civil ceremony, well, I can always divorce him, but I need a place to live.
So you didn't have a place to live at this point?
No, my parents had said that if I ever went back with him, that they would disown me. And I believed them.
Did they? Do you think they would have?
Well, I had no contact with them until I became pregnant a few months later. And then we started to reconcile. The situation was really bad with him. He was a drug addict and an alcoholic and refused to work. And he was violently abusive towards me. And so when the baby was a month old, his father and my mother did an intervention and came and took me and the baby away from him and moved us in with my parents. And that's where we stayed for the next 6 years. And that's where we were living when I finally went back to college.
So you go from being the star student, scholarship to Johns Hopkins, to being home, single parent. How did that feel?
Oh, horrible. Let's put it this way. I was not a very pleasant person to live with, and I regret that. Thank God my parents were patient. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there I was, 20 years old, a single welfare mother with no job, no money, no education, no car, no driver's license, no money, nothing. I started with absolutely nothing except a month-old child to take care of.
Wow. How did you do that? I mean, do you look back on that time still today and be like, oh my gosh, how did I do that? Because that sounds very hard.
I guess at my age now, I look back and I say, wow, you know, you really started from way back. You started this race with lots of handicaps and from a very far distance. And it was actually my mother who, after a year of watching me kick around angrily, said, look, you know, you've always been good in school, so why don't you enroll in the local college called Mount Aloysius, at that time a junior college, now a college, and study nursing. You can be a nurse like me, and you'll always have a job, and you'll be able to provide for your daughter. And I said, okay. So I applied and got in. And after two semesters of doing patient care on the floor, as we called it, I realized I could not be a nurse. And so I switched into liberal arts and graduated with an associate's in liberal arts. And I loved liberal arts. I mean, it really opened up the world for me. For the first time, I heard classical music and I saw great art. I got an internship with John Murtha, who was at that time our congressman. And I went to Washington, D.C. and, you know, stayed at American University in a dorm. And I got to see what a city was like and be on Capitol Hill. And really, that school just opened up the world for me.
Yeah.
And I'm now on their board of trustees. I'm the vice chair of their board of trustees. So it's my way of giving back.
Which is amazing. What do you think it was about liberal arts that was so life-changing for you?
It showed me that there was more to the world than where I had been living and where I'd grown up. It allowed me to look at other cultures, at different ways of thinking. You know, I studied philosophy for the first time, and I continued my studies in French, which helped me later in my career. I guess the biggest thing is that it just opened up my eyes.
Yeah. And one of the things I really respect about you when you talk about this, you really adore the community you grew up in. It wasn't that you didn't have respect for that community. It's just that you needed to know that there was more, that that was a community in the context of a whole world of communities. Mm-hmm. And you needed to be able to see that.
I think when I was younger, I knew I had to get out of here to experience more than what this area offered. Mm-hmm. And now that I'm looking back here, I love it for what it is. You know, I left it because of what it wasn't, and I'm back here because of what it is.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
So you graduate with a liberal arts degree. What do you do next?
What does one do with an associate's degree in liberal arts?
Well, a lot, apparently. We keep listening to you here.
Well, you go on, right? You get another degree.
Yeah.
So I went to the local Catholic college, which at that time was called St. Francis College, but now it's St. Francis University, run by the Franciscan priests. And I feel I should mention that the Sisters of Mercy founded Mount Aloysius, and it was the same Sisters of Mercy that had founded the elementary school that I went to.
Oh, wow.
And so those good women showed up twice in my life when I needed them most.
Wow.
And I am forever grateful to them. They really expanded the world for me, and they encouraged this relentlessly curious child that I was. And they were early role models for single professional women. Mm-hmm. And that order had committed their lives to providing quality education for poor rural children, which is why they came to this area of Pennsylvania. And wow. Yeah. And so if they hadn't dedicated their lives to that, I'm not sure that I would have gotten the same quality of education that I got from them. But anyway, so I went on to St. Francis and got a bachelor's degree in business administration in French. And my undergraduate advisor, who was another strong woman, said, you know, you'd make a good lawyer. Why don't you take the LSAT, which is the entry exam for law school? And I didn't know any lawyers. I'd never thought about being a lawyer. But she was relentless in pestering me to take the LSAT. And so finally, just to make her go away, I took the LSAT and I scored in the 98th percentile. And I thought, oh, maybe she's right. Maybe I should be a lawyer. Off we went to the University of Pittsburgh for law school. I was a single mother and working two and three jobs, just trying to make ends meet. It was pretty desperate for us. At that point, I knew we were poor. But you know, I knew also that law school provided a pathway to the future for us. And so I was determined that I was going to finish. And to be honest, my daughter suffered tremendously during those years because we had gone from the safety and shelter and emotional nurturing that she got while we were living with my parents to this big dangerous city where I was just busy all the time, either studying or working. And she was really neglected. And that was a very rough time for her. And that's probably the biggest regret of my life, that you know, my daughter suffered because of my career. But you know, it's what I had to do in order to provide for us. So nothing in life is perfect. And so she paid a price, but I, you know, I try to make that up to her.
And you pulled her out of that poverty cycle.
Yes, you know, the option was either to leave her with my parents or bring her with me. And we've talked about this many times. And I say, you know, maybe I should have left you with my parents, where you were safe and loved and nurtured. And she says, yeah, but when would have been a good time for you to get me back? And it's true, you know, when would have been a good time? There always would have been something, you know, my career, my travel with my career, you know, all that. So yeah, I brought her with me every step of the way.
And your daughter, it's interesting to think about her place in all of this, because she was born when you were so young, and you have told me you were so excited when you found out you were pregnant, and that was a big point for you, right? When you had her. Just her role in your life was really important through all of this, sounds like.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she saved me. I was on a hellbound train with my husband, and it was her appearance that convinced me to get off that train and to straighten out my life so I could provide for her. And so in many, many ways, she saved me. Yeah. And my whole career was so that I could provide for her. And I was as surprised as anybody that it took on a life of its own. But it was all to be able to provide for her. So my whole life from the time I got pregnant revolved around being able to care for this child.
Right.
Even though I neglected her.
Do you think there's some element of that that was reflective of you growing up? Your parents really came through for you in some incredible ways, but in some pivotal moments, they also, for example, said you couldn't come home. Do you think that that influenced your parenting at all?
I think that most people want to be better parents than they felt that they were parented, you know? And so, yeah, I wanted to be there for my daughter in ways that my parents weren't for me. But, you know, maybe in other ways, I was there for her in the same way my parents were for me. You know, I never said that I would disown her, but, you know, I was gone a lot with my career.
Right. And no one is the perfect parent.
No. You know, as they say, you know, we'll all end up in therapy for something.
But I know your parents provided for you and for your daughter in a really beautiful way along this whole process, too.
They really did. And while my daughter was young, they would take her every summer and keep her all summer long because I couldn't afford a babysitter when school wasn't in session. So they were just always there for me and my daughter.
That's amazing. So at some point you move, though. You move from Pittsburgh to, is it Dallas?
Yeah, Dallas, Texas. I got a job using my undergraduate accounting minor, started on the at the very lowest level doing international tax accounting.
Which sounds so, I'm sorry, that sounds boring. Was it interesting?
Oh, it was horrible.
I'm glad I can say that and not have you say, what are you talking about?
No.
It was riveting.
And I was completely incompetent.
Oh no.
Oh, it was horrible. I didn't care if the numbers added up.
Oh yeah, that's no good if you're an accountant.
So I started looking around for a legal job. This French helicopter company called Aérospatiale that was looking for its first in-house counsel in the United States.
So this brought you here to the Northern Virginia area, and this is largely where you had the bulk of your career, or this stage of your career, and raised your daughter, right?
She was 15 when we moved there. So she went to Oakton High School in Oakton. And I ended up staying there in Northern Virginia for 25 years
Wow.
with Airbus, 21 years, always as their head lawyer.
And at some point you decided, which maybe get us into your brain as to why you decided to do this. You make like this huge change, career change. Why?
As I said, my career sort of took on a life of its own. It started out as a way to provide for my daughter, but it just sort of took on a life of its own. And my daughter got married, and there I was with this career. And I didn't know what to do with it because it had lost its purpose in a way, you know?
Right.
I had been doing self-help work for a long time. One book that I read said, if you ever find yourself avoiding something consistently, look at that thing because it's possible that that's where your real power is. And I thought at the time, what do I avoid? And it was very clear to me. I had realized that I always avoided reading anything about environmental issues. And so I thought, okay, let's see if that's true. Let's see if that is where my real power lies. Let's start reading about environmental issues. And once I opened up that door, I mean, it just changed everything for me. By August of 07, I was back in law school at night. So I enrolled at George Washington University in their LLM program. LLM is a master's of law. And then I left Airbus in January of 2011, not knowing where I was going to go or what I was going to do. I met a woman named Alyssa Parker, who at that time was a vice president of the Environmental Law Institute. And she said, what are you doing? And I said, nothing. And she said, well, come join us as a pro bono visiting scholar and give you a platform for, you know, your writing and speaking. And so that's where I went. And my LLM thesis had been on water. Someone told me when you're planning the topic for your thesis, pick something you care about because you're going to be living with that thing for a while. And I thought, well, what do I care about? I care about preventing and resolving conflicts, and where will conflicts arise in the future? It was very clear it would be over fresh water. So I went to my thesis advisor, and he said, well, you know, lots of people have written about surface water, but not many people have written about aquifers. And I said, then that's what I'll write on. During that time, I fell in love with aquifers.
You have to explain for the rest of us, how does a person fall in love with an aquifer? This is not it's not a normal thing that you've said.
Don't hear it very often, it's true.
No, but I do have to say it is very interesting. So give us a little bit, 'cause it's good stuff.
I probably have to ex begin by explaining what an aquifer is. An aquifer is actually water-bearing rock of
So
various types. There are
interesting.
various types of water-bearing rock under pressure. Anytime anyone sinks a well, they're actually tapping into what we call groundwater in an aquifer.
I didn't know that.
I love the mystery of it. 98% of the available fresh water in the world is groundwater.
That's insane.
I know. So what we see on the surface, the rivers and lakes, that's only like 2% of the available fresh water. So much of life depends on aquifers. And so I fall in love with the science of it. And out of the blue, here comes an email from a university called the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, inviting me to apply to get a PhD in aquifer law. Ended up graduating with a PhD in law, and my thesis is on governance of offshore freshwater. It's already been accepted to be published as a book, and people are calling it groundbreaking.
That's kind of a pun. Have you ever noticed that? It's groundbreaking.
Oh,
Has anyone ever
yeah.
said that to you before?
No.
Oh, maybe it's not as clever as I think it is. It is incredible, though. I mean, congratulations. That's amazing. And we will echo groundbreaking.
Okay, thank you. But I think it is very clever, by the way, to say groundbreaking work on groundwater.
It's amazing. And now you ended up returning home. You've taken all of this knowledge, which is incredible. You are, sort of redeeming your first story. And in a lot of senses, we talk about, you know, this first story and then you begin your second story, but you're sort of turning the page and writing a third story that examines and combines those first two and makes sure that you don't live with bitterness towards the first story, but you're bringing healing to it in a lot of ways. Can you tell us about that?
As I'm over in Scotland, my mother who is living in Ebensburg, she was doing pretty well, but she was aging. And so I would come back every winter. Last year, I went back to Glasgow in April, as usual, to continue working on the PhD. And in May, she developed congestive heart failure. And I realized when I got back in July that she could no longer live alone. And I packed up my things and moved back in September. But when I came back, I realized I needed something to do besides take care of my mother and work on the PhD. And I'd already been voted onto the board of Mount Aloysius. So I went to my first ever borough council meeting and picked up the agenda. And it said, due to a resignation, we have an opening on the municipal authority. And I turned to the person next to me and said, what's a municipal authority do? And they said, oh, they're in charge of water. Like, it was really boring.
Wow.
Within a couple of weeks, the borough council voted to appoint me to the municipal authority. And so now I'm serving this town as we manage its wastewater and stormwater services.
It's come full circle.
It really has, to my great surprise. I am really very happy here.
Yeah, I just think that's so beautiful, how you've been able to go back and this place that had some level of hurt for you. I mean, I know that your story kind of tracks a lot of different places, but that you're really bringing hope to that. And it sounds like you're doing some healing work on yourself too, as the longer you live there.
Well, it's true. Yeah. And I can't say there was any, and maybe I'm greenwashing myself. I don't know if there was bitterness and I don't know if there was hurt towards the area. I feel as though I'm coming full circle and healing with my mother on an individual level, because we had a very difficult relationship for many years, although she showed up for me. She was an abused depression era orphan, and there's a lot of emotional damage that comes with that. So I went away and I gained knowledge and skills, and now I'm bringing the knowledge and the skills back to this area, and I hope to be able to benefit the area.
And you're almost stepping into a role that someone else filled for you a while ago. So I mean, you definitely spoke of some poverty and that lack of opportunity, but you had so many people in your community who stepped in for you and tried to fill in the gaps and give you opportunities that you deserved. And now you're doing that as well.
Right. I want to be able to help them to realize that, you know, there's a broader world out there. And yeah, I want to get much more involved with the young people around here.
And I know, going back to what we said about Tina, I think it's so amazing that we heard Tina's story. We heard some of the things that challenged her and so many of the people who really helped her through that process. And you're one of those people. So getting to hear from you, even in the context of we've heard from someone who you've impacted, that just gives another layer to this story. And I love that.
Oh, yeah, me too. You know, now, Tina is wonderful, as you know. Tina's an amazing story.
Yeah, she is amazing.
Talk about a strong, resilient, brilliant woman.
It's special. Yeah, she's an amazing person, as are you. This is just seeing how all of these things weave together, I think, is my favorite part of your story. I mean, you're obviously a very interesting person. You're doing things that really no one else is doing. And something that strikes me about you is, we have a lot of amazing people in Northern Virginia. We have so much industry. We have so many big businesses. And you never know what the person who lives next door who has an amazing career has been through. And I think you're a testament to that. I mean, we've all been through stuff, but this is just an example of one of those stories. And they really make us who we are.
Well, thank you. And thank you for the work that you do in the community. Really, because as you said, there are many people who have difficult beginnings.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can lose hope, you know, and there are times when I lost hope and I just thought, oh my gosh, you know, I'm just going to fail in life. And so thank you for the work that you do to help other people. It's really important.
Yeah. I think just hearing these stories is, it's important. The vulnerability is valuable. So thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
thank you so much for listening to this season of Second Stories. It has been our honor to share each of these stories and to dig further into important issues like abuse and trauma. We hope to keep going with a third season next year, and you know what that means. We're looking for more Second Stories like these. If you or someone you know has a second story to share, or if you have any feedback about this new season, please reach out to us at communications@second-story.org. This podcast is really fueled by you, your vulnerability to share these stories, your eagerness to listen, and your momentum in spreading the word. If you're inspired by these stories like we are and want to make a difference, we invite you to donate to Second Story. And you need to know something important about that. Second Story makes this podcast in-house with our own communications team and our amazing technical producer, Franklin Bond, who believes in our mission and generously donates his services. That means that your donation will not fund the production of this podcast because we already have that covered. Your support will go directly to helping more people like the ones you heard this season write their second stories. Second Story helps hundreds of young people every year write second stories like these, and your support lets us do that. Visit second-story.org/give to contribute. And more than anything, thank you again for listening. Until next time.